Meandering in the margins of medicine, it's the Shortcoat Podcast.
Weird news,
fresh views,
helpful clues and interviews
by students for students.
Subscribe to our weekly show at theshortcoat.com.
It's the Shortcoat Podcast. I'm not even sure that I can hear myself today. There we go. It's the Shortcoat Podcast. I'm your host, Dave Etler, and I'm surrounded by the beautiful people. I have to my left, Melissa Palma. Melissa Palma.
Oh, hello.
Hem.
I have next to her, Makun Premkumar.
Hello.
Over there is Casey McCleary.
Hello.
And over to my right is Zijiang.
Hi.
We're here today to talk about food, specifically Food Babe, who is sort of in the news this week because she is being, like, I don't know, she's kind of being attacked this week. So food, let's talk about Food Babe. Does anybody know, okay, does anybody have like a summary of who Food Babe is for our listeners who don't know? Because I do.
Hit it, Dave.
So Food Babe, a former computer consultant, I believe, who decided that she was going to be a sort of, I don't know, spokesperson, a sort of guru of healthy eating.
Activist.
Yes.
Page says activist.
She is an activist.
A crusader.
So her background her basic background is that she was a sickly child. She had, you know, all sorts of rashes and skin problems and gluten sensitivity or food allergies. She said she had a lot of food allergies. Severe.
Oh, fat.
Quote unquote severe food allergies. And then she decided to take control of her eating, and she wanted to bring her message, her techniques, her knowledge to the world. And so she has amassed at this point an empire. So in 2011, she began, you know, blogging about her experience, on her, blog. She's amassed this following that she calls the Food Babe Army. She seizes her job to go around, holding to the fire the feet of Big Food.
Big food.
So, that's who Food Babe
You're
is.
You're referring to companies, right?
Yeah.
Not literally food
as in
that is big.
Well,
she probably wouldn't like that either.
She probably wouldn't like that either. But big food, processed foods, or even just manufacturers of foods who, use quote unquote chemicals. She's a big problem with chemicals. She doesn't want to, she has said that she will never put a chemical into her body. So you might ask, why isn't she dead? because I think we all understand it.
I think you know what she means,
most
Dave.
Well,
harsh. You know what she means.
Hopefully most of the listeners of our show understand that we are all made of chemicals, that everything we interact with is made of chemicals. Basically, everything that you can see, touch, feel is a chemical of some sort.
Yes. But the problem is that the word she's like contaminated. First of all, she's contaminating the language. I mean, the word chemicals, and this already happened. I mean, this isn't food.
Yeah,
babe.
That's not. She picked up on that.
She just
a lot
picked
of
up on
people.
It. Anyway, the point is that she's contaminating the debate, I guess.
Yeah, I don't like the word chemicals used in this context because it immediately outs you as someone who doesn't know anything about science. If you say you hate everything that's chemicals, you have just outed yourself as someone who doesn't know what they're talking about.
What about toxins? How do you feel about that word, Casey?
Not the way she uses it.
So how does she use it?
Anything that she doesn't like is a toxin.
Mm-hmm.
Or things with more than two syllables.
If a third grader can't pronounce it, you shouldn't eat it.
Yes, she has said that. I don't know if I want my eating choices to be defined by the pronunciation skills of an 8-year-old. You know, that's just probably not necessary.
What about rutabagas?
Quinoa. I didn't even know what quinoa
I think
was
you mean,
until last year.
I think you
so.
Mean quinoa.
Oh, sorry.
Okay. I think she might. I'm not totally sure, but I think Food Babe might mispronounce carrageenan.
What is that?
Let's
make
let's
me happy.
Seaweed.
Let's hear from it is. I think it is. Anyway, I don't care. Let's
you
listen.
Carrageenan.
Let's listen to Food Babe herself here.
Azodicarbonamide, partially hydrogenated oils, GMOs, dimethyl polysoxane, yellow 5, yellow 6, red 40, artificial flavors, saccharin, aspartame, carrageenan, caramel coloring, TBHQ, high fructose corn syrup, sodium nitrate, olestra, potassium bromate, datum. All of these ingredients are not food. They work against you, your body, and your health. Fortunately, you don't have to eat them. Hi, I'm Bonnie, and welcome to the Food Babe Eating Guide. Everybody can eat like the food babe, I'm convinced.
That's nice.
Not that everybody should, but, you know.
Vani Hari is her name, by the way.
I like that she referred to herself in the third person.
Yeah, well, I guess if you're going to have a successful empire of...
She is an entity. She has moved beyond herself into a godlike form.
I think the reason to talk about this today is because these are the people that she calls her food babe army are the people that you will one day be trying to help.
Yeah.
And you're going to, I don't know, like, you're going to have to learn at some point how to communicate with these people, how to maybe even counteract the knowledge that Food Babe has given them. And I use that word in quotes, I guess. do they, so, you know, you're, and you guys are, there's some M4s in the room. Are you ever, is this topic ever discussed, like, in terms of, like, okay, here's how you counteract bad info?
I think that we try to touch on, you know, in a lot of portions of learning how to provide, you know, good patient education is also trying to figure out, you know, you have to ask, oh, how would you like information, or how do you like to receive information? What's your learning style? And for a lot of people, you know, coming, there are people who... trust their doctors, and there are people who don't trust their doctors. There are people who trust science, and there are people who are vehemently suspicious of everything that science stands for. And so a lot of times, you know, Mukund and I are going into primary care fields. We're going to be counseling a lot of patients on diet, lifestyle changes, a lot of the things that that have to deal with food, with healthy eating and behaviors. And I feel like for, you know, a lot of us, we have our own beliefs. We have you know, all of the science to back us up. But if the way that we deliver the information falls on deaf ears, it can be very, very challenging.
So I feel like we're kind of making an analogy that Food Babe is like the Jenny McCarthy of food, right?
I don't think you'd be the first to draw that conclusion. Yes, we are.
So for me, the interesting thing is because of all the, you know, the untrue claims that autism is linked with vaccinations, what is the harm of not eating, you know, yellow 5, red 2, you know, all these things that the food babe is against?
I see.
Is it actually harmful if we don't eat those things? What do you think?
I think so. Something that's really kind of insidious about her things is that a lot of them start off pretty reasonable. Like, most of us would encourage people to eat whole foods. You know, to eat your vegetables and eat your quinoa and eat your whole grains and all that stuff. But part of the problem is it creates unnecessary fear and unnecessary stress. And another part of the problem is when something sounds pretty reasonable to start with, a lot of people can lose track about where it gets unreasonable. So one of the things that I saw that was her advice was don't drink water with meals, which is terrible advice. It's terrible advice if you want to lose weight. You actually should be drinking water because it fills you up faster.
What's her explanation for that?
Her explanation is that it dilutes your digestive enzymes. The concentration of your digestive enzymes actually has nothing to do with how fast or how well you digest things. But she says you should let your natural saliva and chewing start the digestion process and then let it happen naturally, and don't drink water with meals. That's dangerous because we're already, a lot of people in this country are already walking around mildly dehydrated, and we want people to be drinking water.
There's
nothing
so
bad about that. And that, like, that kind of advice, that's where it gets dangerous.
That is exactly what my grandmother believed. When I was growing up, I never had water with meals. That's exactly what she said, based on no science whatsoever.
Yeah. You know, the other thing that I read about is that occasionally the things that she says actually run perilously close to the advice given by people who are pro-anorexia.
Oh,
wow. Good.
So, for instance, let's see, I'm good one.
A is this
good
something
ones.
Called, like, orthorexia?
Orthorexia. Orthorexia, yeah. So, for instance, I don't know how, I'm not sure how dangerous this one is, but we'll compare what she says. This article I read compared what she says to what this pro-anorexia website says. So she says, fast every single day. Fast for at least 12 hours from the time you eat your last meal until the time you break fast with breakfast. Adopting this habit can be so rewarding, restorative to your health, and put you on the path to the ultimate youth and beauty. Okay, so that's what she says.
You're not going to get to ultimate youth and beauty, but it's not going to kill you to skip your midnight snack. I'll give her that one.
So, right. Dinner. This is what you can read on the pro-anorexia website, and I'll link to the article that I read this on. Dinner must be eaten by 7 p.m. After dinner, no food is to be consumed until 7 a.m. at the earliest. This is basically the same as a 12-hour fast. Meaning, if you live by this rule for an entire year, you will have equivalently fasted for 6 months. So, you know, and there's other examples. Like, she advises drinking warm lemon water and cayenne pepper. And the anorexia websites basically says the same thing. You know, none of this is a problem. You know, none of what I've just read is a problem on its own, but, you know, it's taken as a whole. It's a problem. I don't know.
Yeah. So let's backtrack and say, what is orthorexia nervosa? So basically, it breaks down to an obsession with righteous or correct eating, according to the National Eating Disorder Association. So currently, this is not recognized
as a
psychiatric disorder in the DSM.
But I think if you walked into your psychiatrist's office, for instance, with any sort of obsession, they would, I mean, you might not be recognized as an eating disorder, but it might be recognized as something that needs attention.
But I think it's also part of like this kind of like national consciousness about what is the right kind of eating. And so we recently had on campus Mark Bittman, the New York Times food columnist, and he was very, you know, very specific about his message about eating whole foods, eating mostly plants, things that have been said before. But one thing he definitely wanted to point out and say that he wasn't advocating was he wasn't advocating for a specific right diet. He doesn't, you know, you don't want to have anxiety. You don't want to have this fear, this unfounded fear that unless I abide by this diet, I am going to be so unhealthy and place myself in danger. Because yes, there are many, you know, eating habits in the United States that do cause disease, that do cause actual harm. But there's also something to be said about, you know, kind of this national fear of wrong eating, mm-hmm. that you know, leads to a lot of these reactions by people saying, oh, I need to cut out everything that sounds like a chemical or everything that I don't understand. I feel like, you know, there's this overall climate in which, you know, the food war is another culture war.
I could see some of that. And I think that plays into another potential danger of this kind of thing. So we asked earlier, like, what are the harms of following this? So it's not necessarily that, you know, eating whole foods or the sort of generic general advice is bad, but another potential harm is the toxin fear, the chemical fear, is much more likely to keep people away from vaccines. She's claimed she's not anti-vax, but she holds all of the same principles as them. And this goes, most of the stuff goes not just for Food Babe, but for anybody who's out there spreading sort of unscientific fear-mongering information about food and toxins. You're gonna make people not want to take medications or seek out medications or help that could actually be really useful or necessary for them, or for the people around them in the case of vaccines. So I think that's another like potential harm of taking anything she says too seriously.
At her core, I don't think her request is too unreasonable. It's just the fact that she doesn't have a science background and doesn't know what she's requesting. Because I like knowing what's in my bread. I like seeing that maybe the first ingredient is whole wheat flour versus something else, you know? It's not unreasonable to ask companies what they're doing. And it's the fact that she's doing it in such an anti-scientific way.
Yeah.
Is the part that is unfortunate, because what she's actually doing is asking companies to be more transparent, because there's the fear of that too, you know. We're afraid that all these companies are in it only for profit, which
they
are. By definition what they're supposed to do. And on the wayside, they'll put whatever they want to make it profitable.
But so is she. That's the thing. All these people who are like, beware the companies, the big food, the big whatever, like they're all about profits. Like the people who are saying that are also all about profit. She has a book. She makes tons of money off her blog. She makes tons of money off the sponsors that she like recommends their food, and they have ads all over her website, and by like writing columns for things. Like she makes money off of this. Don't think that she's like pure and innocent because she's not a big company. She's making money.
I think the more egregious example of someone doing this is Dr. Oz.
Oh God, he has no excuse. At least she doesn't have a medical background. He knows Oz he's spouting nonsense.
Yeah. Dr. Oz is certainly making more money with her than her, and comes off as very scientific.
You mentioned, Melissa, the food wars and, you know, we're obsessed with eating correctly. And it reminded me of something I read a long time ago, which is basically that, you know, the French would be very surprised or very, they don't understand this idea of food as medicine. Do you have any thoughts about that? Like in this country, like we believe that if you eat the right things.
Yeah, I feel like it's a very American tradition to believe that. You know, I as an individual can have a very lasting, profound effect on, you know, either my health, my destiny, any kind of, you know, the whole, I can solve my problems if I only try hard enough. And I feel like a lot of times that takes certain things in our lives and that kind of divorces them from what, you know, maybe what their actual purpose is. So for me, I'm very much in the purpose of food is for sharing with family. Food is for sharing with friends. And that's very much like a tradition that I come from. But a lot of places, if you don't or are unable to, if that's not the kind of culture you grew up in, if you come from a culture saying you must have this kind of vitamin this day, you must have this kind of, you know, very prescribed, regimented routine, then maybe that's not the perspective you come from. You view everything in your life as a tool to reach some kind of end, which is, you know, it varies
sounds
from culture
exhausting.
To culture. Yeah.
I kind of agree with that. And making some sweeping generalizations here, I mean, Americans, Puritanism, you know, there's always an ism, there's always a movement that people like to take. They like a stance on something. They form associations.
Yeah, and God help you if you change your mind, too. I mean, do you know what I'm saying? Like,
oh, yeah, you're getting crucified if you change your mind.
You know, like and you literally. See this in politics, too. Like, you see this in politics where, you know, like anybody who has, you know, changed their mind is flip-flopped. If you're at all interested in nuances, then, you know, you haven't taken a stand. You haven't. And so, anyway.
That's right. And here's another problem. I don't know if you guys watch Parks and Rec, but when the town of Pawnee starts debating about fluoride in the water, it becomes a big controversy. And Leslie Knope, the main character, comes to the realization that people hate facts and science. It's not sexy. I mean, we can't, I don't know why we haven't come up with a science babe, like an equally appealing to the masses person or spokesperson.
There is
for
a science
our
babe.
Cause.
Whoa.
There is a science babe.
Tell me about science babe.
Very recently.
Yes. She's well, I think she might have been around for a while, but she sort of went.
Okay, well, she's stepping she up the game
jumped,
hard.
She sort of jumped in after this week, I think it was. Yeah. I don't even know if it's a she, to be honest.
Pretty sure it's a she. I don't
know. This person is an analytical chemist with a background in forensics and toxicology. And she wrote an article on Gawker, which I think may have been what sort of set off this recent, like, hey, wait a minute. There's this food babe person out there. Maybe we should talk about her. SciBabe, SciBabe.com. She's dedicated to debunking pseudoscience that tends to proliferate in the blogosphere. So, obviously Food Babe was right up at the top of her list. So there you go. But, I do want to say that this has, so I'm going to reveal why I think this podcast exists.
Drum roll.
Which
please?
One?
This one right here. This one that you're listening to. I want to reveal why I think this is what we're doing here is a good idea because, and I never wanted to do this, but the reason it exists, I think, is because I want to encourage people to, and you can argue whether or not we're doing a good job or not, but I want to encourage people like you guys to start doing similar things when you feel that you are ready to do so. because there are forces out there that are doing things like Food Babe and Dr. Oz and all that kind of stuff. And I feel strongly that there should be an effort underway to counter that. What do you guys think of that goal?
I like it.
It's a great goal.
Okay. Well, like, you know, you can argue whether or not this podcast is doing that.
Because, you know, I feel like for a lot of, you know, a lot of different places where either policy and science come into place or, you know, these camps of anti-whatevers, when, you know, you're trying to, when people hear these controversies and they don't know about it, they want to find sources. They want to find people that they can trust. They want to find out more about it of their own curiosity so they can make up their own mind. And a lot of times I feel like the resources for people on the maybe less, you know, rigorously informed side are held up to the, are seen as of equal value of people who have the knowledge and have the background and have the expertise to make meaningful contributions. And so I do feel like, at least with the Short Code podcast, as medical students, we can practice, you know, effective community communication skills that hopefully we'll be using in our future practices, but also in a way that is accessible to others. Because, you know, a lot of times doctors, we love our big words, we love our terminology, we love our diagnoses, but sometimes that doesn't connect with people who are really trying to find information.
It definitely doesn't connect. I mean, like, think about, you get advice from, you know, during your, I think, at least during your clinical years, probably before that, that says basically, you know, don't do that with your, don't talk to your patients with the long words and all that kind of stuff, because number one, they won't understand it. Number two, it might, you know, sort of alienate them. Isn't that what you're sometimes told?
Yeah. It's scary to people to hear those giant words. And I mean, they're huge, ridiculous, like really scary sounding names for conditions that are not going to hurt you at all. You know, but if you're throwing words around, then people get scared. They don't know what's going on. They feel like they can't talk to you. They feel like you don't understand them.
I mean, science does
alienate.
Science is a language, and it's all about accurate description, right?
Yeah, ideally.
I mean, and so, but the problem with that is that, you know, that level of accuracy is not one that most people are used to operating on. Most people operate using, you know, vernacular English language, which is extremely imprecise, and which is primarily emotion based, I think, right? So that's not, you know, that people aren't used to that level of precision, and it freaks them out, maybe. I don't know.
No, I think that's true. There's also, for me, there's this thing about accuracy. Sometimes I feel like I'm paralyzed about not saying the wrong thing to a patient. Like, I'd rather say nothing, or it comes off as wishy-washy sometimes, because sometimes people like to hear an absolute, yes, I should take the red pill, or no, I should actually take the blue pill. But in science, we're always like, well, 90% of people who take a red pill have a good result, and 50% of people who take a blue pill have a good result. And we just want to be so accurate because we have that responsibility that the message comes across as incredibly muddled and people can't make sense of it.
I'm going to think of the Matrix very differently now. Take the red pill and you have a 90% chance.
But, you know, I also feel like that's part of our training. Our training is to look very specifically at evidence. Our training is to critically analyze, you know, all the different types of information that we have to take in, and then somehow relate that to patients in a way, because most people don't think in, you know, confidence intervals and, you know, positive predictive values. And that's the way that we're trained to evaluate new information. And most people are just like, well, what sounds most like what is applicable to me? And so if it's someone who, you know, you relate to, you connect to, you hear their story, you know about, you know their kids and what meals that they've had, and you say, yeah, I can follow what she's doing, she looks like she's, you know, very successful at having in being able to use food in the way that she feels adds meaning and comfort to her life. And so, you know, it's hard as, you know, as we get further and further along in our medical training, we become further and further away from, you know, the average person's experience interacting with food and media and science, that sometimes there's just this big disconnect that we want to gap, but is also very difficult.
And like that uncertainty that's almost necessary in most kinds of science to acknowledge is really, really scary for people. Just any sort of not knowing, or like having to remember tons of little details and nuances, and our brains really aren't used to thinking like that, and they don't want to. And because, like, we as doctors are trained to do that, like, I totally agree. That's something that we sit a lot more comfortably with because we've had to learn to, but most people haven't learned that.
So Makoon, having had experience in working with children and gastrointestinal disorders, do you have any thoughts from your experience?
About
like how to talk to parents or what questions they have, what are they feeding their children?
So I just finished 2 weeks of pediatric GI. And one of the number one complaints of children is constipation.
Let's talk about that.
And as an aside, it's always fun to Google pictures of poop and ask kids which one theirs looks like.
Never thought of that.
Some are grossed out. Some get excited. It's good. It's a good time.
When they're grossed out, are they grossed out in a positive? Like, sometimes gross is great. Kids love gross stuff. Are they all like, yay, thank you?
I think it's a mixed bag.
Okay.
Oh, that's so gross. Let's all look at it.
Yeah. All right. Anyway, go ahead. Sorry.
I mean, there's a dichotomy. I mean, the fact of the matter is the American diet doesn't have enough fiber. And when you add fiber to your diet, your stools get softer because it brings water in and it becomes easier to poop. But there's a dichotomy between parents who are okay with adding more things that are fibrous to the diet and parents who don't really want to do that just because the things that have fiber are generally not viewed by people as super tasty.
Less palatable, yeah.
Yeah, it's like tough to get a kid to eat beans, lentils, vegetables, and things like that. So there's definitely a motivational piece that comes into play there.
Why is it so difficult for people to eat vegetables?
Because vegetables, they...
I'm speechless.
No, I like vegetables personally, but I can see it, you know? Like, I can see that, you know, broccoli tastes weird or Brussels sprouts are... you know, just sort of odd tasting. Can't you? I mean,
that
even
just means
I mean,
you've never had them properly cooked for you.
That may be true.
It's just the cultural norm, we view those things to be weird tasting, and you have to get used to them rather than being the default.
I like Brussels sprouts, and I like broccoli, but I can still see it. I can see how somebody might not like it.
So I have two things. Like, the first one, I think, is just like evolutionarily speaking. If you're walking around outside and you see a giant steak versus a plate of broccoli.
If, like, I'm walking outside and I see a steak, I will be very just lying there, cooked.
Don't
steaming.
Eat it.
Maybe not the best example. Don't eat the random steak lying on the ground.
All right, yeah. That's
a trap.
Best. Anyway, go ahead. Sorry.
Okay. Anyway, if you see a steak versus or a cake or something that's very, like, calorie dense or rich versus, like, a plate of broccoli, that's what your body wants to eat. So we're really, really drawn to those things because... you know, way, way back in the day, historically, we wouldn't have been able to get calories as easily, and we want to stock up on them as much as we can. Whereas now we're living a lot longer, we're a lot more sedentary, and we don't need as many calories, but our body is still sort of programmed to go after as many calories as we can get. So I think that's a little bit why, you know, given like cake or like a plate of broccoli or a plate of celery, like, we're all going to go for the cake for dessert. The other one, oh, were you going to say something?
No.
Are you sure?
Nope.
Okay. The other one is one of our lecturers was talking about how you have to expose kids to things like 7 times before it becomes a normal thing for them to eat. And a lot of us as children just try things once or twice. And then our parents are like, we don't want to deal with your whining.
Exactly.
So you're not going to have to eat
as
that
as a parent.
Anymore.
Exactly. And, you know, some of us are fully aware of the fact that we're falling down on our job of being parents and saying,
shame.
But at the same time,
shame.
At the same time, it gets really old.
Here's the thing. There is nothing preventing people from making vegetables just as fatty and delicious as other things.
That would be the German way. My sister-in-law is German, And I think the reason, my guess is that the reason her kids like vegetables is because they're always covered in some sort of Germany sauce.
Yeah. Do that if you have to. You gotta roast up your veggies with a lot of olive oil and garlic and lemon zest and pepper flakes, and it's good.
But you're saying
it doesn't have to be like a sad, bare plate of vegetables.
I think maybe in America, we've lost the art of cooking is becoming lost.
Yeah.
Basically.
And this is what Bittman was saying, mm-hmm. right, Melissa?
Yeah. He was, you know, he was kind of delving into the fact that for a lot of people, cooking has become this production. You know, if you can't be a celebrity TV chef and have everything look like a Pinterest photo every time, then it's not worth your time. And he's trying to dissuade people from that fact, saying, no, you can make, you know, delicious, easy meals, you know, in like less than 30 minutes. He has a whole entire cookbook devoted to that.
30 minutes seems like a really long time to me.
Okay. Well, Dave...
I'm being every man here, okay?
Yeah.
This is my job on the show.
Yeah. Thank you, Microwave Dinner Man.
To be every man. And what I'm saying is, you know, my mother sends me articles.
So here's the thing. It's 30 minutes seems a long time to you if this isn't, you know, an important part of your life. If you feel like food is just this way to deliver calories into my body or deliver the micro and macronutrients I need into my body, then okay, that's the importance that you're going to place on food in your life. And so I feel like that's where a lot of people are, out of necessity, because you know Americans work all the time. We have a lot of barriers that prevent us from viewing food as something worth investing time in.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Also, don't do it's a lot if it's 30 minutes for every meal. But if you do 30 or 45 minutes on a Sunday evening and now you've got half your meals for the week, you know, just make a huge thing of leftovers. That's what I like to do. And a lot of my friends will do it. And then you bring the leftovers. Actually, I don't do it. I get my boyfriend to do it. But now the truth comes out. You know, but I mean, he'll spend quite a bit of time cooking, but I get some really, really delicious food and he'll just make it sort of en masse, and then we eat it all week.
Here's an interesting aspect about cooking that I wrestle with. And Mark Bittman kind of started off with this, cooking as a chore versus a pleasure. And if you step back and think about whose role it was to do the cooking to nourish the family. I mean, I'm getting into cooking as fun for myself and my friends, but I think about how my mom had to come up with 3 meals a day, every single day. Well, you know, occasional breaks where my dad would make macaroni or something. But you know, it is a chore. It does take a lot of time.
Yeah, unless you really like to do it sort of outside of its role in just putting some food on the table, because otherwise the neighbors would talk about you.
Well, right. And I've heard about this trend with a lot of different things, not just food. Like people who start off selling little knitted trinkets that they make on Etsy, but then as their business grows bigger, there's more demand to produce. And eventually it takes all the joy out
it's
of creation.
It's a big pain in the butt.
It does become a big pain in the butt. And that's something that I think about. Like, if we do go back to those beautiful home-cooked meals that we like to wax nostalgic about, who has the time to be doing that? And how much would it cost?
You ever picked up a 60s food magazine or cookbook?
Actually, it is cheaper than eating out a lot. I think
it's almost generally always cheaper than eating out, without a doubt.
Yeah.
Can we address my question now?
No.
Tell us about your favorite Jell-O's and
exactly that's what I was
foods.
That's what I was thinking when you said foods of the past. You know, the beautifully prepared foods. I immediately thought of those 60s cookbooks that everything's made with Jell-O and is formed into some weird shape. I'm sure
tell
you're
us about your favorite.
I don't have a favorite. I don't have a favorite because my mother's Italian. You know, she cooked Italian. My father might as well be Italian. So you know, we usually had, you know, a lot of home cooked meals.
You didn't have an aunt who liked the Jell-O molds? And
actually, my grandmother could spend literally hours. My Italian grandmother could spend literally hours in the kitchen making Jell-O. So she would.
Out of horse's hooves?
No, yeah, there was. Yes. Go out back, grab a horse, chop off its hoof. So she would make these layered, you know, so she would put the fruit in. So I gather how this is done is, you know, you'd pour a layer of Jell-O in, then you would add some fruit. You let it solidify, then you would add some fruit. Then you pour some more Jell-O in, let that solidify, then you add some more fruit. And you do this over and over and over again until you get this giant, mega large thing full of Jell-O with fruit in it. And this was her thing.
She could have remember had a whole Pinterest of that.
Yeah. How did it taste, Dave?
It was Jell-O with fruit in it. I mean, it was fine, you know, like, but, you know.
Was it colorful?
It was usually red with colorful fruit bits.
I don't know. I was intrigued by all the layers. Was it like rainbow colored?
No.
Nope.
That's kind of funny if you think back to like.
That's why I think it's weird. Because she spent literally all day making red Jell-O with fruit in it.
I think today they would call that artisanal Jell-O.
God.
Dave, she spent all these hours and you don't even appreciate it.
Oh, I appreciated it. But
I'm
not
hearing the appreciation.
Well, she's gone now. She won't be listening. Anyway, go ahead, Casey. Sorry.
Oh, no, that's fine. I was just going to say, it's kind of funny if you look back to, like, you know, 50s, 60s, 70s, everything was like race toward the future, like space race, space this, Jell-O, crazy new foods, like super futuristic looking things in TV shows like the Jetsons. And now that we're actually almost like...
Oh, we're there.
We're pretty much like, in a lot of ways, we're like living in that future mm-hmm. that people thought would be hundreds of years away.
We all carry supercomputers around in our pockets.
That's right.
Right.
And our food is available to us in like pretty much completed condition.
Yeah. Like
instantly.
Astronaut food to some extent.
Yeah.
And everybody's sort of like, there's a big... I think part of this is like a backlash against
that's
that.
Interesting.
Like,
I don't know why I've never thought
fast.
Of it.
So now we got to get back to Flintstone food.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, paleo. We've got paleo.
This is
we've
the
got,
kickback.
There's the slow cooking movement.
Yes.
Slow
food. Slow
did you guys
food.
Hear about the chewing movement? It's not a thing right now, thank God, but there was this movement about chew your food as long as you possibly can, like before they realized how food was digested and where.
Oh, yeah, yeah. Chew like 30 times and... Is that what you're talking about?
There was a guy who would literally spend all day chewing his food. The guy who, like, pioneered the movement. But, yeah, it was like, chew your food at least 30 times for, like, digestive success or whatever.
It seems socially
Jell-O.
Unacceptable.
It's ridiculous.
You don't have Jell-O. To chew Jell-O. It's just there and down.
I feel like there's some common themes, whether it's Food Babe, who you might think is extreme, versus Mark Bittman, and some people think that he needs to take a stronger stance. I think the common message is, even Bittman quoted Michael Pollan, the food writer, saying people should eat food, mostly plants, and not too much. I mean, can't we all just get along?
That's pretty good advice.
Pretty simple.
Yeah. It's not ridiculous.
Yep. Well, we are at the end of our time today, and I really enjoyed this discussion. Thank you guys so much for...
Did we miss our commercial break?
Yeah, we did.
Uh-oh.
I decided not to do it because we were talking so good.
You rebel.
I'll put it at the end.
But what about the corporate overlord?
I am the corporate overlord.
They're coming for me.
That's me, baby. Thank you again so much for joining us. We will be with you some other time. Next week, probably. All right.
Eat your vegetables.
Eat your vegetables. The Short Code Podcast is brought to you by a generous donation by the Carver College of Medicine Student Government and the Writing and Humanities Program. If you heard something that you liked today, if you heard something that you didn't like today, if you're a member of the Food Babe Army, go to theshortcode.com/tell us and vent your spleen. Yeah, that's all I got. That's my credits for this week. Oh, yeah, our opening music is by Dr. Vox. Our closing music is by C2C. And we'll talk to you in a week.
Inside Stories is an oral narratives project that catalogs the stories of medical students during their journeys through medical school. The podcast is hosted on In Training, the online magazine for medical students. Visit us at in-training.org/inside-stories. Inside Stories is a founding member of Vocalis, the podcast network for medical students. Please listen to our partner podcasts at vocalisnetwork.wix.com/listen.